Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And guys, we are once again blessed with a guest. I didn't really mean that to rhyme, but you know, sometimes these things just happen. This is why we work without a net. It is a real pleasure, kidding aside, to welcome a true lifelong friend, and that is Eric Flint. Eric and his brother Mike and his parents Jim and Donna have been my closest and dearest friends since the late 1970s, which was in the last century. Eric retired from the U.S. Army as a lieutenant colonel, and we thank him for his service both with the Army and with the U.S. Marines earlier in his life. He also retired from the position of executive director of the Army Museum at Fort Lewis in Tacoma, Washington. But as we understand it, that role has sort of pulled him back in indirectly. He's still affiliated. Yes. And Eric is also a renowned historic tour guide, leading tours around Normandy and other historic sites, World War II in Europe, several times a year. So, Eric, my dear old friend and brother, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's apart from your presence, it's wonderful to be here.
And so it begins.
I feel that one coming.
That was our.
We're setting a mood here.
Yes, exactly. Let's see.
Neutral corners.
Right. The last time.
Brian, Jim, great to see you guys.
Oh, Eric, man. You're like the brother I never had. Eric. This is great.
I think we were due for our semi-centennial spasm of sincerity. And now that moment's behind us. Thank goodness. So anyway, welcome Eric to the show.
Wow. Yes. And since we're in the middle of 93, we get a bunch of World War II stuff going on. None of it realistic, but who knows? We can deal with it in a moment. But Hal, why don't you fill us in on this big attack on the Hydra base?
All right. Minute 93. Captain America guns his motorcycle at full throttle through the foggy forest, racing toward the Hydra base. From a side road, six Hydra soldiers on sleek, futuristic motorcycles burst into pursuit, their bikes firing blue energy bolts that ricochet off Steve's vibranium shield mounted on his bike. Steve flips a switch, triggering a Stark-designed gadget. A cord shoots from his bike, stretching across the roadway into the trees, clotheslining two Hydra riders, their bikes crashing in a spray of fire. Steve activates another device, and a rear-mounted flamethrower erupts, engulfing a third rider in flames. A fourth, blinded by the blaze, fails to see an obstacle and somersaults off his bike, letting out a piercing Wilhelm scream as he tumbles. The two remaining Hydra bikers take a shortcut, pulling ahead of Steve. He weaves between them, yanking the pin on a potato masher-style grenade attached to one bike. Accelerating, Steve surges forward as the grenade detonates, obliterating the last two riders in a fiery blast. Ahead looms the Hydra base entrance, guarded by a menacing, futuristic tank. Its cannon unleashes a volley of blue energy bolts, which Steve deflects with his shield, now mounted on his bike's front. The tank lurches forward. Steve flips another switch, and twin missiles launch from his bike, streaking toward the tank. A massive explosion engulfs it, clearing his path as debris rains down.
About 50% Warner Brothers cartoon and 50% Battle of Endor.
Battle of Endor.
a real speeder chase thing. Now, before we get too far into this, Eric, one of the wonderful toys you and I used to play with was a practice hand grenade that we'd run around in the woods and throw it and then yell boom and stuff. But didn't we make a fairly credible looking fake potato masher? Like, I seem to remember like sacrificing a hammer and getting that wood handle and then something on the end. I hadn't thought about it since the late 70s or early 80s, but I'm sure we did.
That is stirring some. Yes. I if I don't remember specifically, it would be unsurprising.
It's plausible. At least
it is absolutely plausible. Though I don't think we went as far as making a significant design flaw as the Hydra folks did by putting easily accessible explosive devices on the outside of their motorcycle. But Well, yes.
You know,
I want to check the statute of limitations before
that's true. But hey, at 10 and 12, we were smarter than Hydra. But I did mean to point out in the intro, and Jim and Brian have heard this many, many times, but Eric is the one who got me into comic books, period, but specifically into Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, who, of course, play recurring roles to this. We've been talking about them a lot, and I've been reading those books again for fun. But anyway, here we go. Captain America, what's the deal?
What
do you got, Eric?
Well, okay. All right. Well, I'll go with this because the motorcycle that Captain America is riding is the classic Harley Davidson army motorcycle. And the US Army had been using Harley and Indian motorcycles since World War I. There are a number of things that say many of the World War I U.S. Army motorcycles had sidecars with machine guns mounted. And I haven't found any photographic evidence to confirm that, but if you're familiar at all with World War I machine guns, they're big and heavy. And sticking one on a sidecar is not a great thing. Now, the Germans had it because by World War II, they had smaller, lighter, like an MG-34 was you could put that on there, not a big water-cooled American Browning 30 caliber. So motorcycles really became integrated into the cavalry when it became mechanized in the 1930s. But mostly motorcycles were used for communication, running messages. In fact, each infantry division prior to World War II, so in the 1930s, and then the mobilization in 1940 prior to Pearl Harbor, each division had at its division headquarters something called a quartermaster car company. Hal, if you remember the project I did for Paul Allen a number of years ago, where I was researching his father's World War II service, well, his dad started out in the Oklahoma National Guard in the 45th Infantry Division, which in 1938 had the unfortunate shoulder patch of a large swastika.
Timing is
everything. So by the way, 1939, after the invasion of Poland, that went out of fashion. So it became a lovely Thunderbird. But so Paul Allen's dad, Ken Allen, was a National Guard kid. He was in a company that had just staff cars and motorcycles. And the staff cars moved important people around, and the motorcycles were almost primarily used for communication. So really, when we begin World War II, that's what the motorcycles are for. And Harley Davidson and Indian in 1940, if you're not familiar, we actually had our very first peacetime mobilization beginning in the fall of 1940. So when Pearl Harbor happens about 18 months later, we already have drafted about 600,000 young men. Every reserve and National Guard unit has been brought to active duty and is being filled with draftees. I mean, we were behind the eight ball on Pearl Harbor, but we could have been a lot further behind. So it's in 1940 that we're not in the war yet, where we start to buy thousands of Harleys and Indians because they're cheap. The Jeep is just coming in, but a motorcycle's cheaper. The bang for the buck. This is my cat. Hi, Otter. Motorcycles are just cheap. And they're reliable. Both Harley and Indian have been making army motorcycles for a couple of decades. So they were just a fantastic thing to have. And as we get into World War II, particularly in Europe, there is some of the cool stuff where they use for scouting and reconnaissance. The vast majority are just for communication. Military police use them. They're great for, you know, traffic control and stuff like that. So even though you're riding around on a Harley with a big sheath on the side that you have your Tommy gun or a carbine stuck into, you're not as cool as you think you are. And unlike the Germans, we didn't go for this. We did have sidecars, but they weren't used terribly often. I haven't seen World War II remount the machine guns much because that really wasn't the role. The Germans do it differently. They're BMWs. They're Germans. They're good at that stuff. The Hydra motorcycles, however,
I was just saying the Germans, of course, had the Kettenkrod as well.
Yes.
Sort of that hybrid tracked motorcycle. But I think in World War II, if you were a German, you were going to try everything once, at least.
Yes.
You know, let's well, put tracks on a motorcycle and see how that works out.
The Kettenkraut, it's actually kind of funny that what's old is new again. A Kettenkraut wasn't as big as a Jeep, but it could hold more stuff than a motorcycle. You know, you could probably, with a Kettenkraut, you could probably throw a few thousand rounds of, you know, 50 caliber machine gun ammunition or a bunch of grenades in the back and move it around pretty quickly, something you couldn't do on a motorcycle. And it was smaller and actually more agile and off-road than a Jeep. Today in the Army, we're looking at these, you know, something about the size of a Kettenkraut that's a fully autonomous vehicle or can be remote controlled. So as an infantryman, you're banging around in the woods, you've got, you know, you can throw your equipment or extra ammunition or whatever, or even evacuate wounded, which is also what a Kettenkraut was very good for, that you couldn't do on a motorcycle.
It's kind of like a Huey on the ground.
Yeah, it was extremely versatile, but I think it still was more persnickety mechanically than even a BMW motorcycle and more expensive than just a regular motorcycle.
And I guess motorcycles in, you know, in all those walled cities, European towns, it's a lot easier to get around in a narrow vehicle.
Absolutely.
Than even a Jeep might not fit.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Both Harley-Davidson and Indian made modified versions of their main military motorcycles. Like there's a special one that was made for the Canadians that was, you know, built to Canadian specifications. So it was a little more robust. Actually, the largest single number of motorcycles we made, about 60,000, went to Russia. In fact, if you want to get super nerdy, so many of these, particularly Harleys, but Indians as well, were in the United States when the war ended. The government wanted to get rid of them. So you could buy a Harley or an Indian in in the late 40s for nothing. And that's part of what led to the biker culture. You know, the founding of the Hells Angels, and these were typically World War II veterans who were, you know, looking for something, and that these bikes were very easy to modify. And it's truly out of those World War II motorcycles that you get the biker gang choppers and these heavily customized bikes, to the point where an original World War II Harley or Indian became so rare that it wasn't until the fall of the Berlin Wall, all these thousands of essentially pristine, unmodified, unmolested World War II motorcycles were in. I knew about sort of the transition to American biker culture in the 50s and the 60s, but when those guys get 50, 60 years old and now have money and want something pristine, got to go to Russia for it, because we sent, again, tens of thousands of them. We made a smaller number for the Brits and a few other places, but mostly it was for the U.S. and Russia.
Oh, we've been talking. I've been tippy-tapping on the computer, and the internet tells me that Captain America's motorcycle in this, the actual prop, is based on a built around a 2008 Harley-Davidson Crossbones made to look like a vintage 1942 WLA Liberator. Mm-hmm. And the Hydra motorcycles are modified cross motocross chassis, Hondas. They're Honda CRF 250Xs, motocross bikes. So they just put a bunch of stuff on some dirt bikes and sent them after Captain America on his Harley.
Well, at least they kept it in the axis.
Yeah.
They did. They do look like a coffin nose cord that reminded me of those louvers that are around that are around the front tanks.
Yeah, nice Art Deco touch there.
Eric, I got a question about Captain America's weaponry. One of the things that he seems to have is that flamethrower. I know that napalm came out in the early in the war, like 42 or so. Can you give me an idea of history of using napalm versus like gasoline powered flamethrower? What kind of material would he be using if he was going to be spraying something flammable over his pursuers?
Sure. I think we're a little bit of movie magic that you have a motorcycle that spits flames. Or if you're familiar with the German flamethrower, it's a Flammenwerfer, and it's known for werfing Flammen.
As one does.
Well, it's just like the Nebelwerfer, which werf Nebels, a missile launcher. Napalm for use with a flamethrower. Flamethrowers in Europe were not used as much as they were in the Pacific, particularly by the end of the war. The introduction of napalm, it was more stable than the gasoline, the previous mixture, because that's why you had these different tanks. You had to have an assistant flame of Flammenwerfer, just before you turned it on, had to mix the various liquids to create the flame. And so napalm was a little more stable. I'm sure when a typical person thinks of napalm, they're thinking of, you know, its use in the Vietnam War, and it was used heavily in Korea, but it was not used much as air delivered by aircraft. We had incendiary weapons. The size of the tanks that you would need to produce that amount of flame would be significant and add a lot of issues to the bike, engine stability and stuff. It looks cool. Apparently, you can also do it to an Aston Martin DB5.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. Q Branch must have picked it up from the SSR. So,
or one of several Batmobiles.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so somewhere between Q, George Barris, and Howard Stark. You know, we figured it out.
Yeah, maybe Ambrose Peavy may have come up with something in there.
Yes. Yeah, Peavy could have done it too. Yeah. He could have figured it out. Eric, one thing that I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up, and that is, and we've been discussing a little bit lately, you and I offline, along with your brother Michael. If you could ride any fictional motorcycle,
I know where this is going. Yes,
would you ride Captain America's, sort of somewhat fictionalized, but plausible Harley, yes, flamethrowers aside, one of the Hydra bikes? Or would it be Ace's flying motorcycle from the classic movie Megaforce?
Well, Hal, I think you already know the answer, that it would be Captain America's modified Harley, but I would only do it if I could wear Ace Hunter's extremely tight gold lamé jumpsuit. So
that is the only right answer.
Yes. I don't think you would chafe as much on the Harley as you would on the actual Megaforce bike.
Probably not. Eric and I had both just contributed to a crowdfunding campaign to a film that came out fairly recently as a recording. It's called Making Megaforce. It's a look back on that 1982. Is it a classic? I don't know what to call it, but proud to see both our names in the credits. And it is a fascinating look, a really well-made look at a really, really terrible movie that we have deep affection for. So,
but just one thing to tie into military motorcycle use. This is something I remember as a kid about the time Megaforce came out. And I honestly think I read this in Soldier of Fortune magazine in like 1981. At Fort Lewis, Washington in the early 1980s, the Army took the 9th Infantry Division, which was at Fort Lewis at that time, and it became an experimental motorized division. At the time, we either had regular infantry guys who walked around, or we had tanks and, you know, armored personnel carriers. But the Army said they needed something in the middle. And so they developed this motorized concept, but they didn't have the actual vehicles. So they said, hey, go and get us off the shelf stuff and we'll see if the idea can work. The Army still had motorcycles, but really by the 1950s and 60s, they weren't necessary. They didn't fit into any organization. And they weren't part of, you know, the Cold War 1970s Europe mechanized forces. But so this division in Fort Lewis was using off-the-shelf dune buggies, Tenuous sand rails, which are the exact same vehicles used in Megaforce, and dirt bikes. The Army, when it was looking for, hey, what kind of surrogate vehicles can we use to test this concept, they saw Megaforce. You've got it was the New Mexico National Guard, Hal, if you know, who are the bad guys, but it's U.S. Army tanks and armored personnel carriers. And here are a bunch of dune buggies and dirt bikes running circles around them. And the Army kind of went, hey, we can do that.
So it's like Rat Patrol, the Next Generation. Is that what I'm understanding? Okay.
Absolutely. And that's really where the motorcycle gets reintroduced to the Army. Eventually, it's only going to be like Rangers who use them, U.S. Army Rangers, who one of their key jobs is to parachute onto to seize an airfield. And then they will land planes. And then they have these cool, they used to be modified Land Rovers, but dirt bikes. So a lot of my friends who are in the Ranger battalions in the 70s and the 80s and 90s, they got to run around on dirt bikes. But but we still use them today, but in a very different role from World War II.
Oh, while we're talking Captain America motorcycles, there's a bit toward the end of this minute where Captain America takes shield off his back and puts it on front of his motorcycle. And I've got to believe that that's a nod to the 1979 Reb Brown Captain America movie and series.
Yes.
Where Reb Brown's Captain America shield was more or less transparent. It was plastic transparent, and he could use it as a windshield. It looked exactly like what Steve Rogers does in this movie, what Chris Evans does in this movie. And just for the record, in 1979, Reb Brown was riding a customized Yamaha TT500. So if you want to have a Captain America motorcycle, go get yourself a 1978 Yamaha.
Captain America on a Japanese motorcycle.
Did the other film, Captain America film, did he use a motorcycle at all? I mean, I know the Reb Brown.
Yeah, you're talking about the, I know the one you're talking about. I don't know. It's been a long time since I saw that.
Because it actually had a red skull. And I mean, yeah, the Reb Brown is classic. The only problem with that, with his portrayal of Captain America, is he didn't get to do the Reb Brown yell. If you're familiar.
Oh, you're digging deep
on
that
one. You're talking about the Matt Salinger movie in 1990.
Yes.
I don't know if he had a. I don't recall if he had a motorcycle.
I don't recall that. They also what's just generally for the Joe Johnston Captain America is I can remember going and seeing it with a nerdy friend of mine. Hell, I remember George Leonard.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yes, Doctor Colonel.
Yes, Doctor Colonel.
PhD, MD, and a colonel in the army. Wow. And we went and saw Captain America when it came out, and both of us were Captain America nerds, but we're very pleased that with the key facts that they changed, like with Bucky, were so well done that it didn't detract. Whereas the 1990 film, I think they fiddled with it enough that it became incoherent. So that's my.
I think we all agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah, with that, that's come up more than once. Now, having said that, of course, the chance to have David Hasselhoff come back as Nick Fury after his Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. movie that I don't think anybody's ever seen, that would have been spectacular.
Yes, the young man in the back row there, I think it's him.
Yes. I saw that.
Right? Did you see it? On a list that I feel like I have some obligation to watch.
I did actually rewatch it a couple years ago.
Did you?
Because I'm going, I feel like I watched it. It was kind of fun, but it was painful.
Yeah, no.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Eric, I have a question about the tank that we're seeing, the Hydra tank. Is that reminiscent of any other prototype anywhere? I mean, it reminds me of the 80s tank game. It looks like an arcade tank game, and I can't imagine.
Battle Zone. Yes. It's vector graphics come to life.
Actually, fun fact about the game Battle Zone is it was the most realistic virtual tank training software out there because there wasn't anything. And the U.S. Army actually bought a bunch of those console or the standalone games and just took the thing that the little thing, the reticle.
Yeah,
the
little periscope thing. Yeah.
Yeah, the little periscope. They changed it to what an actual one at that time, an M60 tank, which was the Army's main battle tank. And that the reticle was like the sight in the M60.
Wow.
And they put them in enlisted clubs and stuff like that. I'm not sure how much that enhanced our readiness and, you know, in eyeing down the Russian bear.
Well,
but
all Battlezone ever told me was reverse as fast as you can. Just keep retreating.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you're going to stay alive and retreat.
And look like out for giant slow X's in your face.
Yeah. The Hydra tank is pure fancifulness. There's nothing that I'm familiar with that's it's similar to.
I've seen a description of something like it as it was a Pinewood Derby car whose dad didn't love him. So it was.
They don't really show much, but I'm looking at it here toward the end of the minute, and you know, it doesn't even have treads. It's got like big rubber tires on it. I'm not sure it's a tank at all.
The closest I could it is the French had something called, I believe, the AMX-30, which was a wheeled vehicle with a tank turret on top. But you can only go so big with that. And I don't, you know, we never adopted anything like that. We went full tread, no one else that I'm aware of. So a wheeled tank-like vehicle was not.
Yeah, the British had smaller things, like the British had the Ferret.
Yes.
And things, but we grew up anyway calling those sort of armored cars and not distinct from like Brinks trucks and things, but that armored car idea that's, and I remember going to a British car show several years ago when we were involved in that, and there are, you know, restored Ferrets in the U.S. They're street legal,
Oh, wow.
Just amazing. They're powered by Jaguar XK engines and
park wherever you want.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. And, you know, road rage is a thing of the past.
Well, if you look in the, particularly like the 20s and 30s, yeah, the British and some other European countries got into the armored car concept. So you'd have like an armored car chassis with a turret and maybe a machine gun on the top. And quite a number of these wound up in Africa in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in, you know, the colonial wars of that period. I'm just kind of think that would be a miserable vehicle to kick around in the heat and humidity. But yeah, what's you're getting to kind of what the Army tried to do in the 80s with its motorized division is you had light infantry, which were super mobile. You could deploy them anywhere in the world, super fast, but they didn't have much firepower. And then we had all these great tanks and armored personnel carriers and all this stuff, but they take forever to deploy. So you need that. We were looking for something in the middle. I think that's part of what the French did when they tried to come up with a wheeled tank. We recently tried it with the Stryker combat vehicle with putting a main gun on it and just said, okay, the only tank you can have is a tank. So it has been a never-ending struggle.
It's amazing how you see ideas like that come and go and come and go. And, once in a while, somebody rediscovers something. Like we'll be talking in future minutes about the kind of the evolution of the flying wing and how that was a concept that was tried by the Germans, and Jack Northrop picked it up, didn't quite get there, but then eventually technology caught up to it. But more often than not, these ideas come up. So it says, hey, wait, I've got an idea. What about a tank with wheels? And then we go through history and we show every 20 years how somebody else has tried it. Yeah. But what struck me so much, Eric, you were talking about the battle zone thing, which I didn't know that, but I remember you and I have talked many times over years about Megaforce and sort of the Army taking some cues for it. The United States Army was basically us in the late 70s and the early 80s. It's going to an arcade. They're playing battle zone. We're going to see terrible movies. It's just, they're just getting ideas from it and stuff. And you know, you and I are just eating popcorn and red vines.
Well, I think the only fundamental difference was that a soldier in the early 1980s, and I actually lived in West Berlin in the 1980s. That's how I found out about the Battle Zone game. It was in Stars and Stripes, was that you and I didn't drink back then. But even at 15, seeing a young American soldier come out of the military class six, alcohol store with a case of Budweiser in Germany. It's like, why? But even I knew that was wrong. That was just fun. I'm 15. I don't drink, but even I know that's wrong.
Even though that Budweiser has no place in Germany.
Yeah.
Here, here.
I was wondering, I just was looking at a picture of a ferret, and it carries two spare tires. Is that correct? I guess they're expecting, well, they're going to get shot out from under us. So get ready with the jack, because we're going to be changing tires most of the time on the field.
Well, and that's the biggest problem with any kind of wheeled vehicle, even like a great big Stryker. They can have all kinds of things. They can be the toughest wheels in the world, but they're still a tire.
Yeah.
They're not a track. So again, we're fighting against physics. And until we can alter that, we're still sort of limited.
Yeah. I was thinking
that's
maybe
generally Brian's department.
If they bought maybe titanium fenders, that might slow it down or something. Wow. Well, this is a pretty good minute that I think is pretty representative of what we were looking for in a Captain America movie. This is what we wanted to see. We wanted
Absolutely.
To see him using all the tricks, all the tools, and you know, he's even using his shield on this thing, but he's plowing on ahead. At this moment, we think by himself. Getting ready to knock on the front door, as we said in the previous minute. I do like this version of this. This is, for lack of a better term, this is Steve Rogers at his purest. There's no, there's no question. You know, he's not questioning what his motives are, what he's doing. It's like, this is my mission, and I'm gonna win here. So, I'm enjoying minute 93. Seems to be one of the most enjoyable. For you know, he's not reacting, he's acting. So I do like that part of the minute.
When I was rewatching the minute, I remembered when I first saw it, and I remember viscerally that feeling when this was happening. And I guess subconsciously the mix of the absurdist, futuristic Hydra technology and Captain America on a, you know, an all-American Harley Davidson, you know, with the Tommy gun sheath, but that's what he was attacking this futuristic stuff with was an, you know, it was like when they showed Captain America doing the rescue and he's got a steel helmet and he's wearing like paratrooper pants and a leather jacket. So it's that wonderful mix of the costume and real GI stuff, even when it's facing, again, the absurdist futuristic Hydra vehicles. So that I remember that just being that this, okay, this is cool. I'm having fun watching this.
Yeah, and I think Joe Johnston in this moment, you know, Joe was so involved with things like Return of the Jedi with ILM doing Raider stuff. This is so reminiscent of all the stuff that he was involved in. So he obviously learned well and knew how to deploy it in his own movies. I know we talked about it in the beginning of this episode about it reminding you of Endor. But that's what you want. That's what you're going to buy the extra size bag of popcorn because this is the thing you want in a movie. You know, don't make me think too hard. I just want to see him do stuff and outwit his opponents. And here we are, you know, in a whole different century from that happening that we can still enjoy that kind of action.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, this has been a great minute, Eric. Thanks so much for joining us. You're always you give great content is that's what I tell Hal, and it's nice that we can chat about these things. I just wanted to give a behind the scenes thing. We did try to get the Harley Davidson Museum to join us, but they didn't want to join us, and I don't know why. they're just down the road from Hal. So if anybody from Harley Davidson is listening, I'm sorry we missed you, but we got the
lost opportunity, guys.
Yes. So we've got a guy who knows how to promote his museum and knows about Harley Davidson's in World War II. Eric,
I think you're going to say exactly what I was going to say, Jim. Go ahead.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Lewis Army Museum and what people can find there when they visit?
Certainly. The Lewis Army Museum is on board Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It's a joint U.S. Army and Air Force base outside of Tacoma, Washington. It's housed in a historic World War I era hotel. And what we do at the Lewis Army Museum is we tell the story of the U.S. Army in the Pacific Northwest. We go all the way back to Lewis and Clark, the namesake, Meriwether Lewis, for the installation. And the Army has been integral in the Pacific Northwest, you know, full time since the 1830s. So we tell that story, the founding of Camp Lewis during World War I to today. And so you're walking through the evolution of the Army. We also have a gallery dedicated solely to the battle history of different units that served at Fort Lewis, starting with the Philippine-American War in 1899 all the way up to the present. But one of the neatest things is we also have a open vehicle park where we've got tanks and artillery and missiles and all kinds of cool stuff. But inside, we have the only surviving Army Chenoweth Sandrail fast attack vehicle from the 1980s motorized experiment. And there's no admission. As of now, civilian, you know, non-DOD ID holders, it is actually a pretty simple process to go to the front gate, say you're going to the museum. They just run a quick check and you can get a pass. We do have a public access parking lot and we're working with the green suit, the Army folks, to get that accessible to the public. Right now, the museum is open to the public Wednesday through Friday, 10 to 4, but we're looking to expand that. And I will put in a plug that the U.S. Army has been trying to shut our museum down for reasons we can't figure out, but thanks to the intervention of members of Congress, they stopped it. And awesome. So we're potentially, what we hope is that in the future, and by the way, we have amazing support from our local command, all the way up to the three-star general who's commanding, are huge supporters. So we know that the museum will be there and available to the public. So if you're ever scooting up north or south on I-5 in the Tacoma area, you can't miss us. Come by and see. It's really an incredible place.
Very cool. Wow. Well, again, Eric, thanks so much for being a part of our show. We love having you on. If we ever do one of these again, I'm retiring. I don't want to do this anymore. But if Hal can get you on his next 8 or 10 podcasts, I'm sure he'll reach out. He loves talking to you. I know that.
So and if we don't do Megaforce, I'm disowning him.
Yeah, the Megaforce minute. Yeah.
We do like the Megaforce 90 minutes, though, where it's just one episode that covers the whole film, and then we move on with our lives. I don't know if I can do that one at a time.
Yeah.
Hey, I think this minute's really bad, too.
I think if we just cut out everything where we have to look at Barry Bostwick's personal area in that tight jumpsuit, I'm just... I know that affected you very much as a young man, Hal.
It really did. It changed my life in ways I'm still dealing with.
But
balanced it out a little.
Yes. But I would be very, very happy to do that. And Jim, Brian, not Hal, this has really been a lot of fun. And please, any opportunity to talk about nerdy, you know, come on, comic book and military stuff is just wonderful.
You're our go-to guy. Don't worry. Wow. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for staying tuned to our show. If you would like to continue this conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listener space over on Facebook. If you do like the show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this particular episode. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests like Eric. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.